It's my honor this evening to introduce Dr. Joseph Sittler and to welcome him to our theological conference. The first thing I want you to know about him is that he was born on September 26th, 1904. This is his 73rd birthday. Cake to present to him. The cook wasn't ready, but I think the song will express our sentiments to him. And you can say a personal happy birthday to him afterward. Maybe we'll do something special in the fireside room. Dr. Sittler was a graduate of Wittenberg College and Hammer Divinity School, and he served a parish in Cleveland Heights, Ohio for 13 years. In 1943, he was appointed professor of systematic theology at Chicago Lutheran Theological Seminary, and in 1957, moved a short distance to become professor of theology at the Divinity School of Chicago. He is now professor emeritus, but he is not retired, as his appearance here and elsewhere is certain proof. Among the many honors that he has received in recognition of his outstanding service to the church and to the world are some 10 honorary doctorates. In addition to his teaching and training of numerous pastors and theologians, he's been very active in world Lutheranism and in the ecumenical movement in particular. He's been a member of the Faith and Order Conference, a delegate to the World Council of Churches at Evanston, and especially at New Delhi in 1961, where his provocative address on Christ's Lordship of the Cosmos stirred his listeners and the theological world. He is the author of numerous publications, among them an old ethics text of mine called Structure of the Christian Faith, other books such as The Ecology of Faith, Care of the Earth, a book of sermons, Anguish of Preaching, and a book on Essays on Nature and Grace. None of these are bedtime reading. They provide very provocative, stimulating thinking. He's a much sought-after lecturer. He's delivered a number of well-known lectureships, including the Lyman Beecher Lectures at Yale, William Noble Lectures at Harvard, and one more familiar to us here on the West Coast, the Earle Lectures at the Pacific School of Religion in Berkeley. Perhaps most indicative of his theological concerns are the numerous invitations he has received to serve as chapel preacher. The invitations are too many to list for you, but they remind us where the heart of Professor Sittler's concerns have always been, namely in the proclaiming and living out of the gospel. Before coming here, a colleague of mine at Pacific Lutheran University, who was a graduate student at the University of Chicago, told me a story that may be a bit apocryphal, but he says that there was a graduate student who came up to Dr. Sittler after one of his lectures and was awed and said, "Dr. Sittler, I'm so overcome by your eloquence, I can't remember what you said." He is a delight to listen to, but I advise you to listen closely to what he says. He has certainly been one of God's rich gifts to our generation. In a Festschrift, the German word for a book in honor of someone, which was given to Professor Sittler on his 60th birthday, entitled The Scope of Grace, the editor, Philip Hefner, points to a note which is sounded again and again in Sittler's work, the note of the unrestricted scope and nature of God's grace, a grace that reaches out into all the orders and structures of the world, as well as into individual lives. And it's the realms of nature and grace and their inseparability that are at the core of his thought and of his vision of the cosmic Christ. And as a result, his interests are far-ranging. The care of the earth, the theology and the arts, worship and symbols. And on the way out here, I heard that he is honorary chaplain of the American Guild of Organists. Also, he's interested in the history of the church and current ethical issues. And all of them are carefully considered with a clear reference to their biblical foundations. And so few are better qualified to address us on our theme of the church in a new age than Dr. Sittler. And we warmly welcome him to our conference this evening.
Thank you, Dr. Pilgrim. It's a kind of salute to the honor in which I hold this place and its reputation for sobriety in theological things that I choose to take very seriously the theme you gave me, in fact, the theme of the whole week. That is, a careful attention to a new age. Now, most of us know that we do live in a time which is bewilderingly and frustratingly new. But most of the time, we are so bewildered by the newness that we do not really specify very carefully just what's very new about this appalling time in which we live. And therefore tonight, in these periods of reflection with you, 4 hours, I want to try to do several things. I should like to try to specify as precisely as I can exactly what is new about this last third of the 20th century. And having to some degree specified that, to ask what it means for those of us who live and think within the Christian community, what this thus specified newness demands of us as theologians, as teachers, as preachers, as believing Christians. Now, in order to make a kind of preface to the way I want to use these 4 hours, I want to say several things. First of all, I ask that I have this format, sit down, for several reasons. First of all, I want these to be not written out, prepared lectures. A, because I don't have any. And B, because I couldn't read them if I did, because of a visual problem. But the second more important is that I want to come down hard on the word reflection. And I can't reflect very well standing up. The classroom is really my turf. I like to unwrap an issue or describe a situation or trace back a biblical theme in a kind of leisurely way and not simply throw it at you. And therefore to sit as if in a classroom is a much more appropriate setting for the kind of reflection to which I want to invite you. Now the next prefatory thing is a little reflection on what does one mean by the word theology, and what does theology do? The word means, of course, reflection about God. That's what theos logos means. Reflection about God. And each of you is aware of the many different kinds of operations that go on under the general title of theology. But let me just recall them to you, because I think you need no more than that. There is, for instance, biblical theology. That is a constant and ever-renewed reflection upon the great drama, the episode, the historical accounts, the reports, the remembered occurrences that constitute the whole biblical message. To deal with that, always freshly probing for what it means, always bringing to the probing fresh knowledge, critical, textual, historical, archaeological, philological, all of these are a task of biblical theology. That is, it's theology operating principally within the life world of the Bible. Then there is historical theology. That is, theology not only was, it has been for a long time, and it still is. Historical theology is a kind of ordered recollection of the accumulated history of all the theology that has ever been, all that we can find. It's recorded. It begins within the New Testament itself. There is no single theology in the New Testament or the Old. There are many strands and types of theology. The writer of the fourth gospel does not theologize about God exactly the way the synoptic writers do. And there is growth and development within the scripture. And not only there, but throughout the almost 2,000 years of the life of the community formed by the faith of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and by the incarnation of God in our Lord Jesus Christ, in almost 2,000 years, that an enormous accumulating mass of theology. From Paul, and the gospel writers, Irenaeus, Clement, Tertullian, and St. Augustine, and Aquinas, and Calvin, and Luther, and Knox, and Melanchthon, the list could go on as long as the list of groceries this place must send down to the boat every day. So that historical theology is exactly what it says. A theological reflection upon the accumulated thought about God throughout the Christian centuries. And then there is apologetic theology. That is, shaping theological thought, images, ideas, disclosures, shaping these for propelling into the world, if perchance the world may hear and respond. It's to make an apologia, an argument for the truth of the Christian faith. To use an instance, the late Paul Tillich was a great apologetic theologian. He not only worked from within the Christian tradition, but was always trying to put it in such a way that the unbeliever, looking over the shoulder of the believer, would hear something said in his language, or that intersected his life. Now, my particular task throughout the time I've been a teacher in theology has been something that I only got a name for when I went to the University of Chicago, where my chair was that of constructive theology. Now, but that doesn't mean the other kind would be destructive theology. Constructive theology, as the term was used down there, simply meant the following. It meant that theology not only has been, it not only is an accumulated mass of learning, confession, that has to be transmitted over and over and over again from one generation to another, but that theology is not only a thinking or a remembering or a preserving, it is also a doing. One not only knows theology, he does theology. He not only remembers theology, he remembers it forward into the present, and if possible, into the future. A constructive theologian lives a very perilous life, in that he has to skate on that thin ice where the waters of the future are just beginning to solidify into the present. He lives at the fragile margin of theology, always theologizing in view of what's coming into being, what shapes of the future are beginning to emerge. Let me use an illustration. As a constructive theologian, I have read a lot of things that a theologian really has no business reading. I mean, a conventional theologian need not really attend to contemporary short stories, or to the film, or to the movies, or to the contemporary novel. He need not read Saul Bellow. He need not attend to the fact that millions of young people are reading science fiction. But one who's going to be a constructive theologian is trying to take the pulse of the new generation, not just report the heartbeat of the last generation. He's supposed to try to peer into things coming into form and say, what do they mean by appearing? Now, this means you not only study Bible and theology, but one must also try to keep his ears cocked and his eyes open to what's cooking in the contemporary world. For instance, as a theologian, I'm interested in the fact that I picked up a few months ago at the University of Wisconsin, that on Saturday night at the University of Wisconsin, the largest room in that university is now given over to ballroom dancing. Now, that's when I came in 1927, when I was in college. The girls are wearing long dresses. They are called for by their young men. They are escorted to a dance. It's exactly the kind of thing that was happening in the 20s when I was in college. What does it mean that having gone through the Beatles and all the others, we're now back to the point where a considerable number of young people are now engaging, at least in one major university, and I think it's not peculiar, are now engaging in a fresh renaissance of formality in manners among the young, the last place we would expect it. Now that's a cultural phenomenon of some significance. I think, to make this one little connection that occurs to me, if I were on the liturgical commission that's all hopped up about finding fresh ways of worship that try to catch the musical beat of the last rock, I would be very careful. I would not neglect the fact that the kids seem to be wanting to waltz again. Well, that's enough for that illustration. But so a constructive theologian, and that's what I want to try to make like in these 4 hours with you, a constructive theologian recalls that he must operate, as Karl Barth once said, with the Bible in one hand and the daily paper in the other. That he must try to do a kind of nimble dancing between the great tradition and emerging permutations, disturbances, bewildering changes, peculiar phenomena in the world around him. Remembering that the science fiction of today is the empirical scientific procedure of tomorrow. If, for instance, you were reading science fiction in the 50s, you would be reading speculative, fantastic projections of what are actually being done in the 1970s. And this is true all across the front of culture. Now the next, to move in on the task, the next step would be to recall the new situation. And let me try to work, as I have for a little while, at trying to specify somewhat more clearly than that fat phrase, new situation. What is constitutive of that new situation? What are the components of it? Not just the truism that everything's changing, that these are new times. Well, what's new about the time? Now, I cannot by any means, it's not only a matter of time, no one man can accomplish this, but let me point to some things that are new in our situation. We are often reluctant to do this because it's much easier to simply notice the clamant phenomena that everybody knows about. Computers and little computers carried in the front, in the coat pocket, calculator. That the high mobility of our population, the radical urbanization of Western Europe and the United States, the pace of change. Think back at each of you think of your grandparents. Your grandparents were born into a life which was not terribly different when they died from the world in which they lived as young people. There were changes, to be sure. There were developments, political, economic, social, in manners, in all forms of life. But to have been born in 1904, as I was, when I die, will be a world radically different than the world of 1904, into which I was. There were no radio, there were no television. I didn't see an automobile until I was 10 years old. So that the pace of change has now accelerated with such a frenetic and panicky pace that this has done something which might be called, to use a beautiful British verb, the discombobulation of the head. Our heads are really made fairly dizzy by the pace of change in all areas. Now, so that the new situation certainly means a kind of neurological, moral, common life anxiety about just what in the devil is going to happen next, this enormous advance in the pace of change. But a much more important thing than these surface phenomena of computers and polyester fabrics and fuel-injected engines and all the rest of it, more important than these surface phenomena is the fact that we now live, in Bonhoeffer's word, in a world that's come of age. By that he meant that whereas every generation before the 20th century, every generation lived in a world and also supposed a surrounding spiritual or eternal or heavenly or metaphysical world invisible but there. Medieval and ancient art, religious painting, the common stories of the literature of the past all indicate that men lived in a world which was haunted by the presence of the holy. They may not have obeyed it, they may not have attended to it, but they knew it was there. In Shakespeare, they even swear with religious language. The existence of God, the existence of a realm of the eternal, in which this life is only a bracketed section. That was simply the assumption of life. In other words, the transcendent was the unspoken presupposition of the common life. Not all men were churchmen. Not all people belonged to religious organizations or made religious confession. But all people lived in a world haunted by the presence of dominions and powers, and if they're Christians, they call this God. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. The most profound change in the 20th century is the virtual annihilation of transcendence for millions and millions of people. That's what we mean by secular. Secular in Latin means time, in this period. I think it's safe to say that most contemporary people live within, count upon, use the resources of, find their meanings from, the bracketed reality of human historical life. They do not postulate a God beyond it, or back of it, or under it, behind it. They live within the brackets of, I am here, I have certain potentialities, there is certain knowledge accumulated, it's always accumulating. These are the brackets of promise, responsibility, gifts, with which and out of which we have to shape our lives. So that this radical disengagement of the reality, the promise, the possibility, the meaning of life from any transcendental postulates or presuppositions, this is being rapidly washed out of contemporary life. I don't want to hold forth on this, and I think I need not, because I think what I'm saying is simply a report of what contemporary culture is making clear. If you, for instance, would make a list, or better, take the New York Review of Books list of the 10 most read works of fiction in the last year, you would find not a single book of fiction in which this, and fiction is a reenactment of the human reality. You would not find a single one of those that I can think of, with the possible exception of Saul Bellow's Humboldt's Gift, you would hardly find a one which has any significant reference to the religious background, the moral, religious, or metaphysical presuppositions of another period. No other fiction of no other time has ever been like this. No other painting has been like modern painting. Modern painting is a putting together experimentally, probingly, of colors and forms and patterns that are available in this world. They do not represent anything. If you say to a modern painter, what does it mean? He says if you have to ask this question, you'll never understand it. It doesn't aim to mean anything. It is an effort to probe for possibilities of form and color and texture and movement. But these are all secular things. They are given with nature. You do not have to believe in God or redemption, sin or anything else. So that is the situation that I want to address, not so much address myself to as kindly as rather invite you to presuppose as the background of everything I'm going to say. Now I've called, and I better get on with it, I've called this first period of reflection the new situation in space. I could have used time or other large words, but I choose this one because the illustrations I can garner are, I think, better. A former colleague of mine, a Professor Joseph Hartunian, known to some of the clergy here, died about 8 years ago. He was a dear friend, and in one of his books he had a sentence which I've remembered. Men's bodies, men's thoughts, follow the career of their bodies with absolute seriousness. That is, when men's bodies move into new and unexplored areas, their thoughts are changed by the changed location of their bodies. When we, several years ago, stood aghast, or sat aghast, and watched Walter Cronkite give us play-by-play the descent of the first moonshot, remember. I want to recall to you what you probably all shared in as I did, what I felt at that time, because it's almost parabolic. I sat with my then, about 18-year-old son in front of the television, and here I was, an old duffer, watching this incredible, canny, uncanny, unbelievable, dreamlike performance. Now, I knew enough science to know what was back of it, what knowledge, technique, technology, procedures made it possible. I knew all that formally, but I still sat there with my jaw dropping and thought, it ain't so. This is ridiculous. I still sit in an airplane at 39,000 feet and look down and say, this is nonsense, you know. Here am I eating a lousy Northwest Airlines lunch at 39,000 feet in an upholstered chair. It's a little silly. I'm old enough to really feel that way about it. But the kid sits next to me. He's never been on a railroad. Most of the young people on airplanes today have never ridden on a railway train. Automobiles, they think, came with diapers. Well, I was watching this moonshot, and my son sat back with his feet up with a, sure, they'll bring it off, don't worry about it, it'll happen. He used the favorite phrase of the young, no problem, they got it all worked out. You see, what was happening was to me uncanny. To him, it is only advancing one notch what was perfectly well prepared for and what by scientific and technological logic ought to happen. So that what was incredible to me and somehow induced something almost like religious awe was to him big deal. Now this is a huge change in human sensibility. Other generations have known change and what they call progress, a highly moot word, but none has gone in the space of a single lifetime as fast, as far, as variable as our time. Now this has created a new situation with some kind of, I hope, new concreteness as I've tried to describe it. Now I want to all week be talking about what demands this makes of the religious, particularly the Christian community, and what demands it imposes upon the reflective, constructive theologian. But let me just take one aspect of it. If Hartunian is right, that men's minds follow the fortunes of their bodies with absolute seriousness, something happens to our minds perhaps unaware, but it happens. When our bodies are in outer space, our minds acquire a new sense of space. Let me use some illustration. Take some well-known facts in astrophysics or astronomy. The Crab Nebula, which was only really discovered or brought into men's analytical view about 15 years ago, when a big enough telescope was created to get a good look at it. The Crab Nebula is millions of light years away. It is estimated to give off energy 47,000 times that of our sun. The Crab Nebula is millions of light years away. It is estimated to give off energy 47,000 times that of our sun. Now that's a mind-boggling datum. So that here we live in a small planet, part of a whole system of which the sun is the center, but that is one system within systems within systems within systems. This means that the scope of reflection which engages the coming generation is going to be enormously larger than the scope of reflection of my generation. That does not mean that their reflections will be better or more moral, but it means that the space they do their thinking in, the spaciousness of the data that they must include within their reflection, is going to be enormously larger in space than the kind of thinking I have done all my life. Now, I knew formally that the universe was vast, but the data from the Crab Nebula really hit me between the eyes, because the sheer magnitude, the dreamlike vastness of that kind of a figure is almost more than the human cerebrum can take in. They will live also in a larger world, a longer world in time. You see, I, who grew up on the episodic world of the scriptures, learned that Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees maybe 12,000 years ago. Given the age of man, as has lately been backdated by recent anthropological and other discoveries, the age of man, as we now know it to be, something over 6.5 million years, and that's probably too few, the age that man has been on this crust of this one planet, and God knows what else is on other planets, the age of man from Abraham to now is 3 seconds before 12 o'clock. In the Earth time schedule, since the formation of the probable time of the formation of the Earth by the coagulation of gases and so forth. So that, what does it mean for theology and for preaching and for our religious vocabulary? And these I want to take up in order over the next 3 days. What is the meaning for that vast expansion of space and time in which the act of reflection takes place? Now, let me wind this up because I want to leave a little time for questions here before we go to the other place. The more I have learned as the new natural, social, and other sciences have come within, to some degree, within the compass of my reading and thought, the more I have learned about the way things are, or seem to be, at least, the more relevant, the more intersective with this kind of thought are the biblical stories. For instance, when I was here this morning, or this afternoon, when my friend, the Reverend Mr. Bugey, was reading that fine passage from Ephesians, chapter 1, I suddenly heard a phrase which I must have read many times, but as often occurs to us, when someone else is reading the scripture to us, we hear afresh things privately we do not see. He read the sentence from Ephesians 1. The universe, the whole universe, is being given its unity in Christ. What a phrase. Now, when the Bible said the whole universe, they didn't mean just the district between Abraham and Egypt, you know. They used the whole universe. Ktisis, all that is. They knew what they were saying. These people were not so stupid. They observed the stars. They knew that there were worlds out there. And they knew something, and their ancient poetry shows it, of the dreamy magnitudes that were out there. And nevertheless, they said, somehow, just as the Greek philosophers were saying, we're probing whether or not there is a one in the many, if there is a fundamental unity back of everything. So the biblical writers had a vision of Christ which was not just a kind of subjective, pious blanket for the godly, but Christ has a symbol, a concrete presence in whom the fundamental unity of everything is somehow gathered up. Now I'm making an enormous statement here, that our doctrine of Christ has either got to swing in the same orbits as our minds, that now swing in universal orbits, or the doctrine of Christ will not be a relevant doctrine. It will cease to be heard, not because it's not true, but because it will be uninteresting. When a people's minds follow the fortunes of their bodies with absolute seriousness, and now swing in interstellar orbits, we have to have a Christology whose proposal of meaning occupies the same space, or it will not be an intelligible, hearable, meaningful doctrine. To make it intelligible, meaningful, doesn't mean that people will believe it any better than they ever have, but at least they will know what is proposed for believing. Let me put that another way. I was holding forth one day in a course on Christology and was getting fairly well worked up about this, and at the university we have all sorts and conditions of men and women. Among them, radical Unitarians, who don't believe a word of this whole Trinitarian business. And they're in the class, too, because their dean says, if you deny the Trinity, you better know what it is you're denying, so take Sittler's court. So they were all in there. And I was rolling along, and some student flagged me down. And he didn't know how wonderful this statement is, but he said, you know, I don't believe a word of it. But if it were true, it would do. Now that means the doctrine of Christology, which I was elaborating, at least operated on his racetrack. It operated in his house of thought. He didn't yet believe it, but it was something proposed, and the proposition had the same size as the question. He was asking a big question. What does everything mean? You know, what the kids say, what's it all about? I want to get it all together. Well, the Christian doctrine of Christ
is a massive effort to get it all together, to say, in the many, back of the many, through the many, the one is manifesting his power and praise and glory and meaning. So that when we talk about the new situation, all I'm appealing for tonight is that we really take our theme seriously. And don't just talk about shifting neighborhoods and shifting vote patterns and that some of the wrong people are now getting the vote and that some of the unadmitted people are now being admitted to civil rights. These are all important changes. But underneath are changes profoundly changing the very climate and habitation of our thought, and our preaching and teaching must attend to it. Now, I think, Mr. Chairman, that's enough for this first shot, and we have a few minutes, and I'll ask, because I have not only a bum ear eye, but a bum ear, I'll ask Professor Pilgrim to field whatever question someone might want to ask.
Yes, let's take 10 minutes and then break at 9 and again pick it up at 9:30.
When we talk about a new situation, we're talking about a new situation for the world. But is it not true, not necessarily a new situation for everybody in that world, nor necessarily for everybody that we address? With the message of Jesus Christ. Therefore, that message, are you suggesting, is needs to be multiple, that is addressed to a variety of situations, or that we need to be addressing the new situation regardless of the space in which any particular person is living?
Yes, you're right. I'm not saying that the teacher or pastor or church school teacher or lay people should always be talked to just this way. But these things must not be left out of the general compass of our own knowledge, our own reference. For this reason, that my son, who sat there saying, big deal, or thinking it, whether he said it or not, I don't know. He did look like it, the way he had his feet up sitting. I want to preach to my children, not only to my peers. I want to preach in such a way that the kids now in high school and in grade school will find that the scope of my references to Christ, to God the Creator, the meaning of the world, somehow has language big enough to encompass the kind of questions they are growing up to ask, you see? So that, for instance, my little niece was in the other day, and she's in the third grade. No, she's older than that, in about the sixth grade. And she had her geography book. And I remember the geography book I loved to school as a kid. I learned about how much wheat they grew in South Dakota, and how many cattle they're supposed to have grown in Wyoming, and how many freight cars the New York Central has, and how much wool you export from Australia, and a number of facts about the mountains and the plains, the produce and the oceans. Good stuff, and I learned a lot of that and enjoyed it. But this kid had a geography book, and guess what the first chapter was about? The first chapter was about the formation of the Earth out of galactic gases. She begins her story of life in Chicago out of interstellar space, and then moves into Lake Michigan and Hog Butcher of the World and all the rest of it. So that a perfect illustration, I think. That's what Bugy was saying this morning. Any adequate meaning must be a meaning which is adequate for all that is. And all that is for the new generation is enormously longer, bigger, more complicated than it was for my time. But you're certainly right in that there are many people coming to our churches who are people of God in the church, to whom these changes sort of go on around them, and they go with them, you know. They give with them, reluctantly or acquiescingly or enthusiastically, but they give. The new car will have fuel injection rather than the old carburetor. The new kitchen sink will be a different stuff than old linoleum or wood. They move with these things, but they do not reflect about it, you see. But there are those who reflect, and the church cannot trust her intellectual future to the unreflected.
In light of what's been happening in the last couple of decades with the spirit movements and all this kind of thing and the ecology coming to light, there's been, I think, an embarrassment on the part of a lot of the church, myself included, to try to explain what this doctrine of the Trinity means. And I would like, if you can do this, to give us that explanation that would do for the group that you were teaching that day.
6 minutes. We have 6 minutes to explain the doctrine of the Trinity for today.
No, I won't do that, but I will do something much, much better. In an issue of Dialogue about 2.5 years ago, now you know the journal, Dialogue, from published, I think, at Luther Seminary. In an issue of Dialogue, Philip Hefner, my one-time student and now an esteemed colleague, Philip Hefner has a beautiful article called On Getting It All Together, which is the best contemporary essay on, for ordinary people as well as theologians, on what the church intended and intends by the doctrine of the Trinity. The best one I ever read. And I think if you take that better, that's better than my last minute stab at it now.
We may give you another chance at fireside, but thank you for now. Yes.
I was going to say, you explained the theology of the cross in the view of the cosmic
Christ
and having an adequate picture
to appeal to people. Will you state that question?
Explain the theology of the cross in light of the understanding of cosmic Christ?
You know, my theology of the cross, that is, the centrality of the fact that the appearance of God among men was put to death. That awesome fact at the center of Luther's theology, and I think of mine, has deepened along with the scope of reflection I've been talking about. Because ultimately, earth and space and time do not have within themselves the possibility to answer the questions they generate. Only a God who became this thing was destroyed by it and then survived that destruction. Only that kind of a God is enough. Why? For a very good reason. To refer to a book that my former students, Mark and Mary Ann Miller Gunderson, are here, and when they were in class, I gave them a book from which I now quote. You know, the Earth is a star, and the life of a star is 9 billion years, about. Give a year, not a little here and there, you know. 9 billion years. Our Earth is now 4.5 billion years since its formation, so it is estimated. That means in 4.5 billion years from now, the Earth will have as its nuclear center. Nuclear composition decays, will have bloomed. The blooming Earth will then be over 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. All life will long since have ceased. So the Earth has literally no future. Human life, human history, the human reality is not permanent. That is, eschatology is a cosmic term, not just a historical term. The creation will be rolled up like a scroll in Peter. At least this earthly part of the creation has a term. What does God intend for the future? Now, when we face that fact, we have to revise our eschatology so that only a theology in which all things, all finite things, and the earth is finite, all these things finally come to dust. only a God who in a sense became that dust himself, is an adequate God. Now that's a kind of a new version of Luther's Theologia Crucis. If God is not God enough for that, he's not God enough. But the God of the Gospels is enough God for that. That's why when Paul, in his epistles, you know, people ask Paul that question many times and in many situations, how shall the dead arise and in what body shall they come? Well, in the Thessalonians, Paul gives some first efforts to answer that. But interestingly, in the mature document, the Romans, he doesn't do that anymore. He simply says, if we live, we are the Lord. If we live, we are the Lord. Therefore, living or dying, we are the Lord. That's the absolute answer, you see, of a God who became our situation and redeemed it. So that a theology of the cross can intersect with the new cosmologies and the new astrophysics. And I think it's the only thing big enough, really, to intersect it. Okay. I guess our time is gone.
All right. Thank you again, and we'll welcome you to Fireside at 9:30.